Sunday, big city, taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday. Life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap. If you've got troubles, just take them out for a walk. They'll burst like bubbles in the fun of a Sunday in New York.
It seems that more and more people in the United States have a real interest in and passion for what they eat. Since Julia Child, maybe, there has been a growing level of sophistication about cuisine and an acceptance of it as part of culture in this country. I'm Yael Cassander, and my guest, Daniel Orr, has been at the center of this movement for the last couple of decades. Having grown up in Columbus, Indiana, Orr quickly rose through the ranks of haute cuisine, cooking in some of the finest establishments in Europe, before becoming a star chef at New York's legendary bastion of French elegance, La Grenouille, in the 1990s. Anchoring Terence Conran's first American restaurant, Guastavino's, in New York, Chef Orr subsequently stole away to the Caribbean, where he became executive chef at the Cuisinart Resort in Anguilla. In 2007, Chef Orr returned to the Hoosier State to open his own culinary complex, Farm Bloomington. Welcome, Daniel Orr. It's an honor.
Wow, that's all me, huh?
Tell us about how you started out, your childhood in Columbus, Indiana. How did your passion for food develop?
Well, the whole family's always been really passionate about food. My grandfather, on my mother's side, had a big farm down in Princeton, Indiana, that we would spend summers going down and doing things other than chores. A lot of times we would, you know, pick berries and help him in the garden and make cobblers and that kind of thing. My grandmother and grandfather on my father's side had wonderful garden plots, and they came from Polish and Scottish backgrounds. So, you know, food was important to them as well. And our family just really took an interest in that. My parents are kind of, you know, hippies without the drugs. They love to make their own soap and wine and, you know, grow their own vegetables and be as self-sustainable as possible during the summers and put things up for the winter, and just really took a lot of pride, and we built our family around that. So it's kind of in the blood and in the genes, I guess.
And at which point in your childhood did you know that cuisine and all things food-oriented was your life?
Well, I think that as I grew up, I was rewarded for my interest in food. And, you know, I would get in there for Mother's Day and Father's Day and do the breakfast in bed and go out and pick herbs in the garden and decorate the plates and kind of mirror what my parents had done for dinners by, you know, taking that interest in food. I like to say that most great chefs come from either two different backgrounds, one where the mother was a great cook or where the mother was a horrible cook. And luckily I was from the former instead of the latter.
So that was your informal education. How about your formal education and your path to success?
Part of the reason I came back to Indiana was to get in touch with my roots in many different ways. And I worked in a great restaurant in Columbus, Indiana called the Walnut Room. And it was this kind of underground restaurant that was in an old Elks Lodge that was run by a couple of people that just were passionate about French cuisine. And so I really learned a lot about French food and that old kind of 70s style of, you know, tuit d'Almondine and those kind of things. And so I really fell in love with food there. I also worked for a good friend of my parents, Jim Gregory, who was the chef for Irwin Union Management that runs Cummins over in Columbus. And Mr. Miller had Jim Gregory come over from Cincinnati, and my parents became friends with his, and I became friends with his family. And we would always have these wonderful holidays together where I got to taste things like foie gras and caviar and Bordeaux wine and these kind of things as a younger person and before they were as well known as they are now. So that kind of whetted my appetite for the profession, and, you know, just seeing the passion that these people that I've just mentioned had for food kind of gave me a different culture. And it showed me that there were people that found food is more important than just a way to fill the body, and that even though it is about nurturing the body, it's also about nurturing you know, yourself and other people and taking care of people. And that's kind of how I fell into it.
How dangerous to discover foie gras and Bordeaux wine at such a young age. So then you went to Providence, Rhode Island.
Right. Eventually. Went to Johnson and Wales. I got a scholarship there because I'm an Eagle Scout, you know, so I was one of those good boys, finished my scouting and got a scholarship and then became a teaching assistant and fellowship instructor there. So I got 2 degrees, an associate and a bachelor's, and graduated from there and then moved down with a bunch of my crazy culinary friends to Long Island. And it was the year that the Statue of Liberty had its 100th anniversary. And so we got these jobs on these boats that would go circle around. It was elegant dining afloat. And, you know, I ran a boat that fed 500 people. We had people like Bob Hope doing the shows and entertaining. And, you know, so it was really kind of an exciting time. All the big boats were in New York. And, you know, it was just a really fun time to be there.
And then you made a break. You decided to go to Europe.
Well, after I left New York, I went up to upstate, to Westchester County, mm-hmm. and worked in Rye, New York, at a little place called Le Panettiere. And it was a wonderful restaurant owned by another great mentor. And the one thing that he said to me all the time was, well, that's not the way we do it in France. And I really got fed up with hearing that. And so I said, okay, I'm going to France. And then he'll never be able to say that to me again. So I there was a woman named Ariane Degas who owns a company in New Jersey called D'Artagnan, which is a big supplier. You can go, you know, to the website and find foie gras and confit of duck and different sausages. And she's a great purveyor of fine foods. And I used her when I was at Le Panettiere. So she said, oh, well, you can go hang out with my dad and work with him. So I did that. I worked with him both in Paris and underneath the pyramid at the Louvre. Mm-hmm. And then I went down to his base restaurant in Auch, which is in the Southwest, and really learned about the cooking with foie gras, the cassoulets, the confit canard, the magret canard, all that kind of thing. And he was the first one in France that really did the rare cooked duck breast. So he has kind of a feather in his cap for that. He was the first one that stopped cooking the duck well done and started treating it like a piece of beef almost.
So at that time, which was, I guess, the 80s.
Yes.
The
late 80s.
Transformation from Escoffier and all of the traditional French cooking to Nouvelle Cuisine was underway.
Yeah, it was well underway. There were already some princes of that movement, and André Degas was one of them, as well as Paul Bocuse and Freddy Girardet and Michel Gérard and some of these other guys. And so they were my superstars. They were my superheroes in the kitchen. And I got to work for some of them. Marc Mouneau had 3 Michelin stars at L'Espérance, and I worked for him there. I worked at Chez Bruno in Brussels, another 3-star restaurant. So it was really a wonderful time to be there. You know, at that time, it was all about France. And now it's kind of opened up, and we've wonderful restaurants all over the world. And Spain has had its moment in the spotlight for the past few years. And American chefs are getting very well known as well. But that was really fun for me to be there and to learn from these guys that I admired so much.
Would you say that you owe a certain amount of your sense of style to that experience in France, the sense of, for example, Nouvelle Cuisine, taking something that's traditional and noble and august and having fun with it a little bit? That seems to pervade your own sense of style.
Well, it really does. And that is what kind of the sense of humor that a lot of these guys had was great. I mean, André Degas was a rugby player, and then he produced these wonderful kind of elegant little dishes, and to kind of see how he did that and where he was inspired, and to go back to old dishes and come up with new ways to cook Nouvelle Cuisine a lot of times was about cutting away the roux and the thickeners and all of that the Escoffier sauces had, and some of the egg yolks and butter and creams and that kind of thing, and coming to truer, less, I would say, overwhelmed flavors, but truer, more direct flavors. And that's what I think that the whole movement in cuisine is about now as well.
Yeah, if we think about what you are doing and what you have done with régime cuisine or spa cuisine, in your 1997 book, for example, you tend to base a lot of the recipes on plants and grains, and there's even a whole section that uses tofu as its centerpiece. You also are very interested in enhancing the flavor of food with spices, and you have a whole spice line, as opposed to contributing to flavor with fat and calories. Are you still equally interested in those ideas?
Yeah, I would say that a lot of the current menu is just what you've mentioned. At lunchtime, we love to do tofu and vegetarian sandwiches, and they're very, very popular. Bloomington, I think, really likes that kind of cooking. So, you know, we do a kind of a faux catfish sandwich where we take tofu and we make a little combination of panko, which are Japanese breadcrumbs, and nori, which is seaweed powder. And we pack that on the tofu and quickly deep fry it. And you get this thing, it almost tastes like a fillet of fish. So that's kind of fun. And we do tofu mayonnaise and tofu sour cream. And it's a way that you can get that rich, unctuous flavor and consistency in your mouth without having to go with a real, true mayonnaise or dairy product where you're just, you know, having tons of fat. I think there's a place for those things as well. But it's nice to be able to eat different every day and to spread out your calories in different ways. And when you're going to have that, you know, that great, you know, bison or beef burger with the mayonnaise and cheap blue cheese and bacon and all that, go ahead and go all the way. But then on a lunch another day, maybe you go with a much lighter dish where instead of using the mayonnaise, you use a tahini or you use a hummus or you use a tofu dip kind of sauce. So, yeah, I like to balance everything. I don't cut anything out of my diet, but I like to have a nice balanced diet and try everything.
Well, if we can get back into the historical stream of things for you personally, you spent some time in France and then decided to return to the United States. You wound up at La Grenouille immediately upon disembarking?
No, actually, while I was in Europe, I went to 15 different countries. I had a Eurail pass, traveled all around, wanted to try as many of the different dishes as I could. I went to one of the places I remember always is when I was in Budapest, and I got off the train. It was late at night. I didn't have a place to stay. I found this kind of hostel, or this, it was actually something that they had set up at the train station where you could stay with people and you'd just pay them. And I remember going to this little old lady's house. She didn't speak any English, but her house smelled just like my grandmother's house. And so that really touched me. And she made me something to eat, and we kind of sat and looked at each other and talked a little bit the best we could. And then the next morning, I remember when I was leaving, that I'd been so entranced with our conversation and the whole experience that I hadn't even noticed that she was missing three fingers. And she was talking with her hands the whole night. But it was just very interesting. I was just almost, you know, brought me back to when my grandmother was alive and having that woman there and talking to me. And it was something very comforting. And the smells of the kitchen and all that, that's something that really I think is something that it's a type of memory that I hold very, very dear.
So after your travels, you decided to return to the States.
Right. I came back here, and the first thing I did was I bought a pickup truck, and I took 3 more months off and drove out to Seattle and then down the whole coast of Washington, eating, drinking, seeing what America had to offer, because I saw what Europe had to offer. And so I bought a book by Jane and Michael Stern about road food, and I took that as my Bible, and I had friends in different areas and contacts, and you know, really wanted to see what America had to offer. So then when I came back, I wanted to have a full education, not just be kind of Eurocentric, but to see what part of the American classic cuisine I could incorporate into my own cooking.
What a contrast.
Yeah.
How did you decide, where did you decide to stop, and how did you decide to proceed?
Yeah. Well, I went to Seattle because I'd heard all about the fish market out there and about the wines that were being grown there and then going down to Oregon. So it was really about, you know, where those great ingredients were coming from. And then stopping in Santa Fe, and I had a buddy there that had a fish market, and Mark Miller, who's a very famous Southwestern chef, was cooking, and Jeff had worked with him. So, you know, just, and then went to Houston and Cafe Annie there, which is a very famous restaurant owned by Robert Del Grande, learning a little bit about what he was doing and seeing how he had taken his European inspiration and done regional cuisine with it. went down to New Orleans. That's where I got the call from my mother saying, Lagren, we want you. And so somehow they had gotten the message from someone in France that there had been this young chef there and that he was worth looking into. And so they had found my mother in Indiana, and she, you know, called me, and, you know, I headed back and headed to New York.
Good old mom.
Yeah.
You spent 7 years at La Grenouille?
Yes.
Yeah. That was during the 90s. What a heady time.
That was a lot of fun. Those are, you know, really some great years, not just for the cooking, but just kind of the way New York was at that time. And being a chef in a fancy restaurant and having a book out and all of that kind of stuff, you know, kind of gave me the opportunity to meet a lot of people and see a lot of different things that probably your typical line cook doesn't get to be exposed to.
Tell us about some of the people that you've cooked for.
Well, La Grenouille is always known as a power lunch place, and it's where the fashion people met. So I met a lot of the different fashion designers that would have lunch there. But there were a lot of famous personalities. It's right on 52nd Street, so it's near the theaters, just a little bit off Theater Row. So, you know, I met people like Faye Ray, who was the original actress and the original King Kong, Diana Ross, Aretha Franklin, Madonna, you know, it just goes on and on, Gregory Peck, Placido Domingo. All these people, it was just a wonderful time, and all those people were very vibrant in those years, and many of them were just such wonderful down-to-earth people as well. So it was nice. You see them on TV or you hear about them, see them on the movie screen, and then when you meet them in person, that they really care about what you do and are interested in what you're doing and appreciate what you're doing was something that was very special.
There was a real buzz about the restaurant scene in the 80s and 90s in New York. And it seems to me that maybe more than any other time before it, or perhaps since.
I think so, yes.
There were the impossible to get into restaurants. There was such a great deal of hype about restaurant reviews and these celebrity chefs, such as yourself, who came of age in this era. Apart from being able to meet a lot of celebrities yourself, what was it like cooking in that atmosphere?
Well, I mean, it was it had its joys and it had its negative points as well, because you were always worried that there was going to be a critic coming in and, you know, that these reviews did make and break most restaurants. La Grenouille had such a stronghold and still does as the classic grand dame of French cuisine and, you know, has its clientele. So they weren't always as worried about the reviews as I was. They'd weathered many storms already, and it was actually opened a year before I was even born. So, you know, it had been around. So they weren't quite as worried, but I was worried, but it was exciting. I got some great reviews there and lots of good write-ups and, you know, made friends with people and, you know, W Magazine and some of these great publications. And it was a great experience. Another thing that was really funny is that, you know, I don't consider myself a celebrity, but people would call me because I could get them into nightclubs. So, you know, people would be calling, so Chef Daniel, where are you going tonight? Can I meet you there? Because they knew we'd go through the ropes and everything. So, you know, that was one of the funny things and one of the perks of you know, living in that lifestyle.
So you did get a very notorious, very positive review from Ruth Reichel of the New York Times. If I can just read an excerpt of that. She said in 1997, his lobster bisque, for instance, a marvel of smooth richness with a stock so intense the flavor reverberates in your mouth long after the soup is gone. Or choux farci à la royale, the world's fanciest stuffed cabbage in a highly truffled sauce. The mind reels, the mouth waters. So what was it like when you got that plum review? How can a review like that change your career?
Well, one thing I said to myself is, well, at least Jacques Lupia cannot say that's not the way they do it in France. So my time in France paid off. You know, it was highly complimentary. It probably springboarded me to my next job with Sir Terence Conran, which was a, you know, extremely lucrative job. So that's kind of the thing that really I came out of that was that, you know, I did get this kind of promotion. I started running this other restaurant. It was a much bigger restaurant and probably less old school glamour, But it was very glamorous in its own way. And, you know, we opened, you know, with Best New Restaurant in America reviews from Esquire magazine. And, you know, just had a wonderful time those first couple years there until 9/11 happened. And that kind of changed things and really changed the way I think a lot of people in New York lived. Uh-huh. And so that was a very kind of challenging time for me.
That restaurant, Guastavinos, is located underneath the 59th Street Bridge. It's
right.
One of the most architecturally impressive spots in the country. So I can imagine that after 9/11, such landmarks were probably not as fun to hang
right,
around.
Exactly.
In.
And actually, the power for the Upper East Side came underneath that bridge, too. So it was a site that people were afraid to go to. And so it really changed the way we had to do business. And we kind of changed from being a high-end Euro-inspired brasserie bistro with a fine dining restaurant upstairs to more of an American brasserie. And we had to add kind of a disco on the evenings, on the weekends, and that kind of thing, just to bring in the revenue in this huge space. So professionally, it was a very educational time for me. I learned a lot about business, but it wore me down a bit, and I was ready to get out of there when Lee Rizzuto called me from Cuisinart and said, "Hey, I've got this little resort I want you to come check out in Anguilla." I said, "Perfect. That sounds just like what the doctor ordered."
Oh, good timing.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a short break
okay.
with a little music?
All right.
So you've brought something in for the occasion. What are we going to hear? And why is it special to you?
Well, I love Cassandra Wilson, and I think that most of the stuff she does is really wonderful. I like her sense of humor. I love the rich sexiness of her voice. And if there's ever a time that I need to just calm down and chill out a bit, I love to listen to her, and also I think she's got a great sense of humor. So now we're going to listen to Drunk as Cooter Brown.
I'm Yael Cassander with Chef Daniel Orr on Profiles. When we left off, we were talking about Anguilla. Tell us about life there and some of your culinary discoveries.
Well, it was a little bit more like Indiana than one could imagine. When I was growing up in Indiana, there were still old gravel roads that we would drive down. Most of them have all been paved up now, and you know, a lot of little plot farming and that kind of thing. So it did kind of remind me of my childhood when we got into the interior of the island. It also reminded me of Indiana during my growing up because the people were so nice. Everyone knew one another. There was a sense of community. And that felt really good. And that's probably part of the reason that I got inspired to come back after I left there to come back to Indiana. One of the things that really drew me to Cuisinart in particular was their passion for fresh produce. And they have right on the property a hydroponic farm, which everything is grown in a water medium. And it's very interesting to kind of learn about that whole system. And Dr. Howard Resch is the man who runs that for them, and he's just one of the greatest hydroponic farmers around and helped develop that little thing you see on TV where you can grow your herbs and cherry tomatoes and everything. So it was fun to work with him, and it inspired me to really take one of the outdoor plots and try to do a lot of organic Caribbean farming. So I worked with another great, great man, but of a very different patch of cloth. His name was Franklin Brooks, and He was from St. Kitts and knew how to cook, how to grow things, you know, in the Caribbean. And so he taught me a lot about different ways that you can grow things together and rotating crops and the way that they keep the water and sandy soil from just running away. And so lots of little tricks on growing. And we grew some wonderful organic okra and cowpeas and different pumpkins and squashes and callaloo and all these different things. And that really inspired me to learn how to cook Caribbean. So I kind of went away from the French and developed a more Caribbean style for the resort. And some of that still kind of has come with me and is in my back pocket whenever I'm in the kitchen and still like to pull out some of those different hot pepper sauces and those different organic vegetable flavors that I learned in the Caribbean.
Whether it was in the Caribbean or Europe or elsewhere, what are some of the flavors that excite you the most and some of the combinations?
Well, I think that every region has a way of preserving things and a way of, you know, kind of displaying its own palate. And a lot of times it has to do with temperature. So in India or the Caribbean or in the Far East, a lot of times it's very, very hot and humid. And so they're using a lot of chilies. And I love the way that they use chilies. And then they cool them with coconut milk and cool them with different fruit purees and that kind of thing. So that really intrigues me. You know, here in America, I love the way that the different regions cook, and the Cajun food really inspires me. I think it's one of our true cuisines. But just anything cooked in Maryland, all that fresh seafood, and whatever region you're in, I think that you should eat locally. And, you know, even if you think globally and you're thinking about ways that you can marry maybe a flavor from Thailand with that Maryland oyster, you can come up with something very creative and very fun. And I try to do that with my spice line. So you can go kind of around the world and the different 10 different spice blends that I have. And so if you do a chicken breast every night of the week, it can taste a little different every night.
What informed your decision to come back to Indiana from Anguilla? Was it about coming back to your roots or something more about the simple country life?
Well, a little bit of both of those things, plus a couple other reasons. After leaving Anguilla, which is an island that's 3 miles wide and 14 miles long, which is exactly the same size as Manhattan, I got back to Manhattan where I owned an apartment, and it just didn't feel the same. You know, in Anguilla, there were 11,000 people in the whole country, and in New York City, there are 11 million. And although there's all those people, for some reason, you know, I'd stepped away from that for a couple of years. And when I got back, you know, I felt a little bit lonely. And it didn't seem as easy to meet people as it was in the Caribbean. And I made a few trips back and forth to Indiana and spoke to some friends and some of my past mentors and, you know, came over to Bloomington a few times and checked out the farmer's market and, you know, saw how wonderful the produce was. And although things had changed, there's still a sense of that, still that thread of really good locally grown produce and kind of hominess and back to the earth type of feel that I thought, listen, you know, maybe this is my time to come back. And, you know, hopefully I can also share some of the things that I've learned while I was away with people and have them enjoy some of my history with me.
So Farm Bloomington, which opened in 2007, maybe more officially in 2008, is the first restaurant that you've owned. Statistics, unfortunately, would suggest that it's always a big gamble to open a restaurant. As you were making this decision to open it, did you do a lot of market research? Was there something that convinced you that you could make it work here?
Well, I did do some market research. You know, you think of Bloomington as being a college town. But, you know, some of the things that came out in my research were that it's one of the top small towns to open a business, that it's one of the top small towns for retirees to flock to. I just love the sense of culture and art that are in Bloomington. And coming from Columbus, there's still some of that there, but it's much more vibrant here. And I think it's much more readily available. In Columbus, you have the wonderful architecture. You do have a couple wonderful symphonies and a good visitor center and art center and everything. But Bloomington, I think, just has that feel of a artistic community. And with the young folks here, you do have a younger music scene and the wonderful music school and the art museum. It just was very intriguing and felt like, you know, maybe a couple square blocks of New York City here in southern Indiana. So I really fell in love with it. And I fell in love with the site that I found for Farm Bloomington, which is right next to the Buskirk and has that, you know, the Buskirk has that wonderful neon and just kind of that whole sense of Americana and right next to the courthouse square. And it just seemed perfect. And so I had to grab hold of it.
The site is a former Odd Fellows Lodge.
Yes, the Odd Fellows were in the third floor. My grandparents were Odd Fellows. I didn't really know a whole lot about them, but it seems that they were a group. Probably I wouldn't agree with everything that they believed in, but what they did do was help farmers get through hard times. It was kind of like an insurance policy for that time. So you would pay your dues and you would be taken care of if there was something that happened to your family or the crops that year. So the Odd Fellows were very important in the end of the 1800s and probably through the middle of the 1900s for farmers.
With Farm Bloomington, it is the first restaurant that you've owned. In the past, you've been executive chef, and you've been spending other people's money. What's
right.
it like not only owning the restaurant, but being responsible for every aspect of marketing, personnel, et cetera?
Well, more sleepless nights, shorter bitten fingernails. It's very scary. Plus, I don't really have the life pattern of Bloomington down yet. So, you know, spring break was a shock to me. But I think I'll learn the patterns. I'll be able to plan accordingly in the future. But that first year being open, it's very scary if there aren't people pounding on the doors to come in. So we've done some fun things. We did a Caribbean spring break with my pictures from Anguilla and some great reggae music. And so we kind of have mixed it up a little bit and tried to have some fun with it. And it worked. We had some great response from the community, and people felt like they could come into farm and still get away from everything, almost like a spring break.
Aside from the name of your restaurant, you obviously have farming in your blood, in your heritage, even as you describe the Odd Fellows building. The actual edifice was a place where farmers could seek help. You have been interested in local food production for a long time, and it's something that is catching on in the general consciousness. There is increasing scrutiny to what we eat in terms of its ecological and socioeconomic impact. Whether our meal is contributing to the carbon load, for example, or whether the coffee that we buy is being, whether the farmers who grow the coffee that we buy are being properly compensated. These issues are familiar these days. I even read that the new Oxford American Dictionary designated the word locavore, meaning someone who eats locally produced food, as the 2007 word of the year. You hear people talking about the 100-mile diet, people are shopping at farmers markets. This is all something that is important to you as you go about your business at farm. How are you incorporating the local farmers into what you do?
Well, I think that what I'm trying to do is to almost go back to the way things were before the 1950s. Basically, everyone was a locavore at that time. You know,
right.
You grew your stuff, you put it up, you canned it, you pickled it, you did what you had to do. And so I'm trying to go back a little bit to that kind of way of thinking, giving it my global flavors with my different spice combinations and my personal history. I've, you know, got wonderful friends from Japan and India. So I'm trying to incorporate some of those flavors I've enjoyed around the table with them, but with these local ingredients. And so, you know, we're using local elk, local buffalo, local pork, local beef, local eggs, local cheeses. We're not 100% local. We're trying to find how much of that the market wants and how much they're willing to pay for. And that's one of the whole things during this first year. It really is kind of a time for me to listen and to really hear what people are saying and trying to create a restaurant for the people that live here. So that's part of it. It's not me reproducing what I did in New York City, which would cost, you know, $125 to $150 a plate. You know, I can't do that here and probably don't want to. I've done that. It was fun, but that's not really the way I want to eat anymore. And so, yes, I think that those points that you've just brought up are very relevant to me personally. I know that they're relevant to the people in Bloomington. I love that locavore has become a word. And, you know, it's challenging. It's challenging for me. It's also challenging for the farmers, because the farmers need to be able to come up with the way that they can supply the restaurateurs at a price that we can still afford to turn around and sell them back to our clients with our markup, you know, because we have the place that we created. We've got the heating and air conditioning. We've got the gas. We've got the labor. And so all those things are additional to that product. So it is a challenge to come up with a way that you can make that affordable and still make a profit on it.
There is such an emphasis on local food production these days. Do you think that this is something that will stay with us, or is it one of those culinary fads that will go the way of, oh, I don't even know, sushi maybe is not so popular anymore? Or is being a locavore and eating sustainably something that's with us now?
Well, I think that goes into a lot of very deep politics. So I don't know if this is the place to talk about it. But I will say that, sadly, I think that it is, and very happily, I think that it is. Sadly, I think it is, because I think a lot of people are realizing that, you know, we can't count on these products that are grown all over the world and the cheap fuel that in the past has brought them to us, and that that if we don't start considering eating locally and getting that system built back to where it was in the 30s and 40s, where things are grown local, and you know. If there was something that happened in one part of the country, you would not be affected, because you would have your own individual setup that would be surrounding in your community, and you're used to supporting them and they're used to producing enough food for the community. So I think that we have to, for scary reasons, but also for positive reasons, that it tastes better, it's healthier for you, and why not help your next door neighbor?
I use Anthropology department has just set up a food studies PhD, and it's an interdisciplinary program. It involves courses in biology, health, culture and language, sociology, and it reminds us of what a complex network of forces is at work every time we sit down to the table. What are the aspects of this network that intrigue you the most?
That whole thing of knowing where your food comes from, and seeing the whole cycle, and even kind of developing a way, and this is something I haven't done yet, but something that I look forward to doing, you know, especially when we get more into the local growing season, of, you know, recycling, of developing composting, you know, seeing that cycle of the farmer coming to us and us returning to the farm. And people are doing that here. It's not an original thought of mine. You know, the guys that run Upland Brewery are sending their spent grain to the guy who grows their buffalo for their buffalo burgers. And so there is some of this synergy happening. Jeff Meese over at Pizza Express and the other brewing company, the Bloomington Brewing Company, is also wanting to start a way that he can grow his own local water buffalo and make his own homemade mozzarella. So, you know, there are these people that are thinking in this way of synergy and cyclical growing and using things. And I think that's a lot of fun and very intriguing to me. And as I said in the beginning of the show, we do have a farm in southern Indiana. And part of my grand scheme is to do something on the farm in the future. And if I don't grow things myself and become an organic farmer, to have somebody down there and work with them and figure out a way that we can develop that kind of a situation as well.
I've noticed that you're also a visual artist. And in your cookbook, Real Food, you have all sorts of charming little drawings. You have, for one thing, a great self-portrait that's also a signature. You have schematic drawings of some of the plates that you describe. Has drawing always been a creative sideline for you? Do you continue to do that?
Well, I developed the drawing. I had good friends and did a lot of drawing in junior high and high school and entered some artist competitions when I was a kid. But a lot of that drawing came about when I was in Europe and I would be sketching out what I had eaten so I would remember it. And, you know, that kind of developed. And then when I was at La Grenouille, then I would do that and I would put that up on each station in the restaurant so everyone would know how to produce the dishes. It's before, you know, digital cameras were used everywhere. So now everyone just has digital photography of their dishes. But that's how I used to do it. And then I'd draw lines and write down what everything was and kind of explain it. So it was kind of almost like an architectural drawing of a dish. So that's where I really got intrigued with doing that. Now I'm into the digital photography. Oh. So if you go to the restaurant, you'll see a lot of my photographs on the big screen TVs. I've done a lot of interesting things with the local barns.
Your family has been quite involved in Farm Bloomington. A number of products that your mother grows and makes are on sale there. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what you're doing there, some of the very local items that you're showcasing.
Right. Well, I mean, we're having a lot of fun with it. Some people don't understand exactly what we're trying to do. A big city New York chef comes back and does a farm market that has a very kind of country feel, almost like a Martha Stewart's version of Cracker Barrel kind of thing. But that's really part of me. And so, you know, hopefully people like it. Not everybody likes me. Not everybody will like the restaurant. But, you know, hopefully most people will because I do my best to make everyone happy. One of the things we're doing in that front market is using some of my mom's items, her potpourries, her little succulent gardens. She always comes up with different things for the holidays and is very involved. My father and she both work in our garden at home, and they create wonderful things. And I'm looking forward to using her little cherry tomatoes and her okra and her long beans and that kind of thing in the restaurant. So, you know, it is a family business, truly. My brother's involved, even though he's in Houston. He helped put up some of the funds to start the restaurant, as well as some of my cousins and a lot of great friends, both in Columbus and Bloomington and throughout the country have been very supportive of me. And so, you know, I'm just working hard to make it all happen. And hopefully my dream will please a lot of people and give people a place where they can feel like part of the community, because that's what it really is for me.
We could probably talk all day, but it's time for us to wrap up our conversation. You've chosen some other music to take us out.
Yes, I did. Well, this is something that is very special to me in more than one way. You know, Mel Torme has just got such a velvety voice, and my father loves jazz and always loved Mel Torme, and the song in particular is Sunday in New York, and so that kind of takes me back to New York City. And Sundays were always very special to me in Manhattan because we didn't do brunch at La Grenouille, so we had Sundays off. And so I could actually enjoy my Sunday and go to Central Park and you know, sit out in the sun in the spring and enjoy the city on Sundays. So that's why it is such a special song to me.
Well, we look forward to hearing it. Chef Daniel Orr, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks. It's great talking to you.
Sunday, big city taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday. Life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap. If you've got troubles, just take them out for a walk. They'll burst like bubbles in the fun of a Sunday in New York. You can spend time without spending a dime watching people watch people pass. Later you pause and in one of the stores there's that face next to yours in the glass. Two hearts stop beating.
The program you have just heard was recorded in March of 2008. The technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.